welcome to the latest episode of Dialogue Out Loud. I am Caroline Klein, a co-editor of Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. And today I am joined by Colby Townsend, author of the article, Secret Societies and the Political Context of Joseph Smith's Rewritten Scripture, which appears in the fall 2025 issue of Dialogue. Colby Townsend is a dual PhD student in English and Religious Studies at IU Bloomington. In this article, Townsend approaches Joseph Smith's early scriptures, the Book of Mormon, and his revisions of Genesis as 19th century documents that were shaped by political anxieties of the time. Several scholars have posited anti-Masonry in the 1820s as a main influence on these writings, but Townsend shows us that Smith was also drawing on a broader transatlantic fear of secret societies that went back to the French Revolution and debates about Jacobinism. Colby, welcome. I'm so happy that you agreed to come on this podcast with us, and I am excited to talk to you about your work.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to discuss the article with you.
Well, to start off, what got you interested in writing this article, and what is the main argument that you're making?
So the article itself is a revised version of chapter 4 of my master's thesis. I started off thinking about my thesis interested in comparing Joseph Smith's revision of Genesis 1 through 6, basically what would become later the Book of Moses, with what I had studied as an undergrad researching the Hebrew Bible and early Judaism. So it was kind of different when I first started off, but in some ways it was an extension though of my undergrad honors thesis. Quickly realized though that there was a more interesting story as I started to read late 18th and early 19th century transatlantic literature, especially in the periods, newspapers and periodicals. When I turned to that, I just started noticing so much more that was going on that connected to what Smith was doing. So I argue that scholars that study and write about the Book of Mormon, kind of like what you just said, a very good encapsulation, that study and write about the Book of Mormon, they need to broaden out their narrow focus on specific things that happened only within Smith's area, like anti-Masonry, to the larger transatlantic networks that early Americans like Smith were hyper aware of. So in this case, I'm trying to get scholars to move from the local, both geographically, so from New York out to the larger transatlantic world, as well as in time, so from the 1820s out to the early Republic and Romantic eras, so something more like the 1780s to the 1830s. So doing so allows us to see Smith was in conversation with more important discourses than just the local ones some scholars have identified.
So a lot of people do point to anti-Masonry in the 1820s as the backdrop for the writing of the Book of Mormon and the Book of Moses. But you see a much bigger story, like fears of Jacobinism after the French Revolution. Would you mind just giving a very quick, like, kind of summary of why was Jacobinism so hated? What is it tied to in people's minds? Why is there such a strong reaction to it?
Yeah, I think the easiest way to try to explain that is to just connect it to the face of Jacobinism, Robespierre. You know, the French Revolution happens, and you know, in 1789, and a lot of early Americans were actually very excited about it. They thought, "Oh, okay, great! Like they're having the same thing that we just had. They're throwing off, you know, kings and royalty and all of that." And it wasn't really until large-scale massacre of the royalty that's really the turn.
That's where the turn is. Okay, that's where people get very scared about democracy, when they see the heads coming off. Okay.
Yeah, and that's where the Jacobins come out of. So the Jacobins were, they become this sort of monster, this cliche, this thing in the literature of the period. And Abby Barwell is very much a part of creating this monster. But really all that they were was a group that would meet together at coffee shops and discuss politics. Mm-hmm. And their main concern was making sure that in the new republic, that the Ancien Regime, the royalty and those upper classes wouldn't have much influence on the development of the Republic. That was their main concern. They're usually depicted in the literature as, a secret society. Like they're hiding, they don't want anybody to know where they're meeting, they're plotting to kill XYZ people, right? And with that, all of that leads to Robespierre and the beheadings and the guillotine and all of that. But really, at the very beginning, that's not what it was. It was just, look, if we're actually going to have a republic, the people at the top, all of those people, we need to do what we can through persuasion, through debate, through gathering as many of us together as possible, to fight against their influence, because they're just going to keep it the same. Like they have all the power still, they have all the money still. We're outnumbered. We're not outnumbered, but money-wise, we're outpowered. So you start to see the development of anti-Jacobin parties. So this is why throughout this entire period, you'll see references to not only Masons or Jacobins, but also Illuminati. They get kind of lumped into one sort of almost Frankenstein monster, that they're all, just iterations of the same thing. And that's how Barrowell actually talked about it, is that this is just one thing.
I love that you got into this bigger context, which I found very helpful and interesting. And another thing I love about your article is that you really dive into the scriptures. You really dive into Book of Mormon as well as the revisions to Genesis. And so I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how these figures, like these biblical figures, like Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, were actually being used in political debates about order and rebellion. So this is again kind of setting the bigger context. Like this is in the water right now. Several writers were using these biblical figures in a certain way to talk about politics and then also discuss how Joseph Smith is doing the same thing in these early scriptures.
Yeah, no, definitely. Yes. So European and American authors regularly referred to Adam and Eve as our first parents. That also appears all over in early American literature. And many scholars have written about the central role that they played in portraying the importance of family and government during this period. So related to this, Cain and Abel became an image of both how family and government could go wrong. So Adam and Eve were this, like, the perfect symbol of perfect household. Here, like, yes, they fell, but look at them together. They're our first parents. And then, of course, Cain and Abel. This is where things fall apart. So although the text of Genesis does not say why Cain killed Abel, for millennia, readers have offered numerous ways to understand what might have motivated Cain. In the late 18th and early 19th century, one common interpretation was that Cain murdered Abel so that he could have his property. That comes up all over the place. This fit with one major interpretation that I highlight in the article, which was a review of Abby Barrowell's 1797 to 1799 four-volume memoirs illustrating the history of Jacobinism. An extremely popular book at the time, read all over the place in early America and in Britain. Abbé Barrowell was a French priest. He escaped the French Revolution and moved to Britain, wrote that there. And although he tried to pass it off as a kind of journalistic history, it was really just a polemic against the French Revolution and the supposed origins of the Jacobins, and particularly the Enlightenment more broadly. He was very anti-Enlightenment. So in this review, the anonymous reviewer praises Barrowell's memoirs, but claims that he leaves out some of the most important history for understanding Jacobinism's origins, sorry. So while he loved this reviewer, loved the book, he was kind of like, I can kind of one up you a little bit. I have a little bit more to say. Yeah, you do this important work on the origins of Jacobinism, but the reviewer points to the Bible and to Milton's Paradise Lost in particular as providing this missed context. So they list what they think were the first stages of Jacobin history, what they think we can learn about the early chapters of Genesis with Milton's help. So first, the first act of Jacobinism in recorded history, that's a term that he keeps using. So history here is, obviously doing a lot of heavy lifting. But yeah, in recorded history was Satan or Lucifer's successful attempt to convince a third of the host of heaven to fall with him. So Jacobin was understood as intentionally lying to, riling up, and through those lies, and making violent large numbers of people. So getting large numbers of people to, you know, like in that first act, leave heaven, right? Nope, we've all fallen. We're all going down to hell with Satan. So that's the first act, according to this reviewer. Also, democracy was often viewed as mostly, if not wholly, susceptible to Jacobinism because of this. So there were actually, it's surprising, and it was early for me surprising, to find out how much anti-democratic literature there was in early America. Very, very surprising. I didn't expect that when I started this kind of reading. And it comes out of fears of the French Revolution. So democracy viewed susceptible to Jacobinism. Reviewer refers to this as an insurrection in heaven. He actually uses that language, clearly connecting it to the overthrow of government. The second act in Jacobin history was when, according to this reviewer, was when Satan approached Eve, so crucially here without Adam present, and convinced her through cunning and argumentation to eat the fruit. The reviewer believed that Satan intentionally sought out Eve alone because he believed that women were weaker than men and more easily caved to the pressures of Jacobinism and their persuasive tactics. He actually uses far worse sexist language than I'm using here. So yeah, first one again, the third of the hosts of heaven falling with Satan. Second act in Jacobin history, Satan approaching Eve and getting her to eat the fruit. And then the third act, according to the reviewer, is when Satan approached Cain and taught him that he could murder Abel and gain his possessions. So according to the reviewer, and this is also, I think, really pertinent to today, Satan is a foreign intruder. Mm. This might start to sound familiar. And wanted to teach Cain how to rob, steal, plunder, and cut throats. So that's a quote from the reviewer. The motive behind the Jacobin's actions might come from a desire to attack the possessor of wealth and office because he wishes to and expects to obtain the same advantages. But it also might simply be because the Jacobin is anarchistic and loves chaos. So he had all of those explanations. It's not just necessarily one thing. According to the reviewer, quote, the history of Jacobinism furnishes parallel instances of men who plot day and night to ruin the happiness of others when they have no idea of ever coming in possession of it themselves. That is, they do mischief for the sake of mischief. So
yeah,
it can be all over the place.
This is so interesting. And a bunch of questions are popping into my mind right now.
Yeah.
So sorry if I'm like cutting you off.
No, perfect.
But I guess I'm surprised that a country that had only very recently been formed through insurrection, through rebellion, and that embraced itself as a democracy. How is there this much suspicion towards, democracy when this is how the country very recently was formed?
Yeah. I mean, it was ironic to me as well. And, you know, a friend of mine that's in the religious studies program here with me, he started a year ago and he and I were chatting and he said, you know, if you were to try to describe America, American culture, American history, all of it in one word, what would it be? And I the best that I could come up with was contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of those moments where it really does seem like a contradiction. Like, yes, it's a democratic republic, but you would still think that democracy is important, that the involvement of the people, right? You can't get away from that with reading the founding documents of the country. We the people, right? It's not we the, you know, oligarchs that have been put in charge of the people. You know, it is we the people. So yeah, I think that it's sort of an accident of history, right? And they believed that their form of government was better, right? They talked about it as an experiment, surprisingly to me as well. In the early 19th century, 18-aughts to 10s, most of the founding fathers actually kind of lost faith that the American experiment was going to continue. So, and that's right around the same time of some of the literature that we're talking about. So I think that for them, it was, you know, okay, we are scared of mobs. We're scared of riots. We're scared of the potential for insurrection. So very quickly, you have this turn against sort of popular dissent.
Well, let's move on to like the bulk of your paper, which is really about what Joseph Smith is doing in these early scriptures to make arguments against rebellion and insurrection, or at least he's putting very like you would say anti Jacobinistic sort of ideas into these scriptures. And of course you are approaching the Book of Mormon and the revisions to Genesis as 19th century documents. Maybe you could start with Adam and Eve. How does Joseph Smith kind of rewrite in some ways the Adam and Eve story to get some of these ideas out, these kind of anti-insurrection, rebellion, lawlessness ideas out?
What I found really what was fascinating was that as far as the Adam and Eve story goes, it's actually what they're saying in Smith's revision of Genesis 1 through 6 is a repeat of what Lehi says in the Book of Mormon, and it's revoiced. They say basically the same things. It's not verbatim, you know, quoted. Some of it is, but most of it isn't. It's just, it's the exact same things. It's about joy and bodies.
Right. You know, fall actually being sort of more of a fortunate fall with joy resulting from this. Yeah, I remember, and you're right that these ideas voiced by Lehi and voiced by Adam and Eve in the revision, very similar ideas that are coming out. But these ideas are not in particular, like the way he's portraying Adam and Eve and Lehi in this moment are not particularly related to the anti-Jacobinistic rhetoric that will come out with Cain and Abel. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's related in the sense that it is the opposite of what you find in the description, at least, of Jacobinism, I guess. I was going to say Jacobin literature, but Jacobinism. Because, you know, the sort of polemic against Jacobinism is that they're just miserable.
Right.
Right. They're super unhappy with themselves.
They're trying to make everyone else unhappy as well.
Exactly. So yeah, with Adam and Eve, it still stays with that kind of positive, you know, the positivity, right? Of, okay, here's the first family, then, you know, the first parents. And it's not until after them that you get the bad, right?
Right.
So you have, you know, of course, in Smith's revision of Genesis, Satan approaches Eve through the serpent. She, you know, eats the fruit, and then they get kicked out. But then there's that sort of ecstatic moment where she says, no, it's a good thing. And, you know, what Lehi said is split into both of them. So Adam says some of what Lehi said. Eve says some of what Lehi said. So that's really fascinating to me, because it's being, you know, taken into that. And the title of my thesis was Rewriting Genesis with the Book of Mormon. Mm. And I did it because of that, right? So he's actually rewriting these chapters.
Yeah.
And so like
you said, it's like an opposite thing. So the fact that he's talking about Adam and Eve and joy and the purpose of humankind to experience joy, this is like a poke at Jacobinism, which people are portraying as all about misery. So it's kind of it's a contrast thing, right?
Yeah. 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 And I do think for Smith too, not to correct that language at all, because it is, I do think it goes back to Jacobinism, but I think for Smith it's just kind of unchristian, you know, or just, you know, just not, you know, irreligious or whatever it would be, you know, for anyone who kind of comes from that world is going to be miserable or whatever. Yeah, so I want to make clear, because I know that this comes up as well in Mormon studies, that people will be like, you think that Smith was, you know, exactly responding to Jacobinism, and I'm like, no, this is the larger world that he's in and that he's reacting to, but I'm not even sure if he would have known, you know, Jacobinism by name. And I don't think he read any of the literature that I bring up either, but this is the literature that people were swimming in, that this is, you know,
it's like in the water, it's in the discourse of what's swirling around him. That's really helpful. And yeah, really, maybe you can also talk about Cain and Abel, because that's where the real talk about, you know, the anti-rebellion and secret combinations, all of this, that's where that really comes in, right?
Yeah, and I think that this is more important for the Book of Mormon, because, you know, if the Book of Mormon only referred to Adam and Eve and, you know, that we can have joy, we can have bodies, we can have children, all of that kind of stuff. If it was just that, like that, those ideas don't really have any direct bearing on the Book of Mormon story. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the Cain and Abel story have a direct bearing on the larger narrative arc of the Book of Mormon, and the larger narrative arc of the smaller stories like the Jaredites. Because what I think is happening with the Book of Mormon is that Smith is engaging with larger ideas about the origins of the Native Americans and trying to present a revealed past about Native American origins. So it's not directly Mound Builder theory, but it's related to it, and it's very well connected to it. And in order to tell this story about, okay, there was this ancient white race, Nephites, and there was this ancient darker race, Lamanites, and the Nephites died somehow, it becomes crucial throughout the narrative for as the way that it's written and portrayed, to have inward disputes, secret societies, bands of robbers, just ruining the Nephite society and civilization. And without this version of and reading of the Cain and Abel story, you don't have all of these things that happen in the story of the Book of Mormon. And it's not like I'm just saying that, they bring it up. The characters in the Book of Mormon bring up this interpretation all throughout the book. They'll even in for one example, in the Book of Ether, daughter of Jared, not the brother of Jared, different one. The daughter of Jared, even says like, hey, why are you so sad that you've lost the kingdom that you took from your father? All that we have to do is base our approach to this on the scriptures that we've read, that old story we've read about that guy, Cain, that was taught by Satan and, given oaths that you can murder and get gain. So all that we need to do is bring Achish over. I'll dance for him. He'll want me, he'll want my hand in marriage. And to be able to get that, you can tell him that you want the king's head. Mm. So there's clear connections there, obviously, with the New Testament.
That's
as we
really
all.
Interesting. Yeah. Right. That she takes it all the way back to Cain. Okay.
Yeah.
It's like this idea of plotting and overthrowing. Interesting.
Yeah. And this oath and this secret oath, secret combination, right? And that's maybe I should define that at some point too, but the secret combination itself is an oath that you bind each other to, right? They didn't anticipate that Achish would then turn that on the king, and later he kills the king. So that's the other thing about this.
So it's like just turmoil and chaos is going to result when you follow this particular path. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's always about the individual getting power, taking advantage of large groups, and murdering to be able to get what they want. And so Jared does that, but then only a little while later, his son-in-law that helped him ends up killing him. And then, of course, the Book of Ether is all about just wars and loss. And, the end, of course, is just these two fighters and the end of the civilization. So that also is sort of a microcosm of the larger narrative arc of the Book of Mormon, right? It's kind of almost like a warning in the Book of Mormon to the Nephites. And then outside of that, the Nephites are sort of a warning to early America.
Right.
And again, you don't have any of that without this reading of Cain and Abel. Mm-hmm. And this idea that Satan has approached Cain and taught him an oath, and that he'll be able to go out, they'll keep it secret, kill, it's fine, right? So yeah, that connects perfectly with anti-Jacobin literature. It is all about this, the language, the themes, the sort of cycle of small group, then takes oaths, goes out, starts to murder. And this is all over in not only the politics and the newspapers, but it's all over in the literature of the Romantic and early Republican era in both Britain and the US. Charlotte Dacre, in her Zofloya or the Moor, fantastic Gothic romance, plays on the same theme. The entire thing is about a secret society that is, and it's the main protagonist is actually part of this society, And they're all kind of plotting to kill different people. They love that person. They've just fallen in love. So they're okay, I'm gonna kill their spouse. And this guy, this Zafloya guy, is gonna help. And at the very end, Zafloya comes out as Satan.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. So this is a very recurring theme. During this period, it's just all over the place. It's ubiquitous.
Oh, this is so interesting. So one of the things that also I was curious about, and this may be outside your scope of research, but clearly in this reading, Joseph Smith is very concerned about these secret combinations, secret societies, plotting, overthrowing, rebellion, chaos resulting. And Masonry is tied in with this. It's Jacobinism, it's Freemasonry, Illuminati, it's all this stuff. Do you have any ideas why then Joseph Smith seems to later, at least in some ways, embrace Masonry, because so much of our temple endowment is based on Masonic rites. I don't, again, this is not in your article, but it is something where I was like, huh, these are all the negatives, Masonry, Jacobinism, and yet later on he seems to be interested and incorporating. So do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is really fascinating. It's kind of funny. It's one of those contradictions, I guess, which highlights, the Americanness, I think, from my perspective at least, of Joseph Smith's approach to this. What I can say is that, I think that by the 1842 or so that Smith joins Masonry, I think in Nauvoo as well. I think at that point he's changed quite a bit. And he's gone through a handful of city building projects and moving and expulsion, and he's been in and out of jail, and he's seen all of the different things that he's seen up until that point. And I get the sense at least that at that point he views Masonry in a very different light. He, as far as I know, and I don't know this for sure, because again, I'm not an expert on Mormonism and Masonry, especially during the 1840s and after. But I think that some of his family might have been Masons before him, and so I wouldn't be too surprised either if some of them said, "Hey, this could be a really good way to kind of get cohesion, to get people, in." And he'd already been super interested in temple ritual up to that point. So maybe once he learns about some of the Masonic rites, he's like, oh, those are kind of the perfect symbols that I would like to use over here. But I think it's a really good question. And there are lots of books out there like that have tried to kind of explain some of that. I know Michael Homer has a book from about a decade ago. And yeah, I'm not sure if there's like a super satisfactory answer to that, but other than I do think that what Smith was doing in the Book of Mormon and his revision of Genesis is very different from what he's later doing. I think that what he was trying to do in 1829 and early 1830, 31 with the revision of Genesis was responding more specifically to what he saw going on in the United States at the time. And by the mid-1830s to the early 1840s, Second Great Awakening was really going at that point. And yeah, I think he just didn't have that same view at that point. And yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't maybe as pressing a concern as it had
Yeah.
been in when he was younger. Okay, yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate that. It's hard when someone asks you a question that's not actually in your paper or you don't address it in any way, but I found that very satisfying. So I appreciate that. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but so maybe I'll just end by asking if there's anything else you would like to leave with us about this article, things that you think that we haven't touched on that you think are particularly important or some thing you want readers to take away from this article in particular, or any points that you think are important that we just haven't touched on?
Yeah, thanks. I hadn't thought about that. That's a really interesting question. In my published essays, I've always tried to kind of invite scholars within Mormon studies. And this isn't to say that nobody's doing this, but to invite more scholars in Mormon studies to kind of look outward and to try to actually think, okay, what was actually going on in the world at the time? And so I hope that this article helps people to at least think about that. And just as a methodological move, I think it's really fascinating. I think it's really important. And I know, you know, for Latter-day Saints, the Book of Mormon is scripture, right? So that puts it in a kind of a different category. But as scholars, I think it's also really important, even if, you know, someone in Mormon studies isn't necessarily studying the Book of Mormon itself, it's also important to take very seriously that the Book of Mormon is also early American literature, right? And for those of us outside of the tradition, taking it seriously in that way, most people that I know, especially in early American literature, love this stuff. Like even if they don't sit, even if they only do literature, they don't do religion in literature. Once I tell them about what's happening in the Book of Mormon or in his revision of Genesis or how that connects to so much of the other literature of the period, people get very interested in this. So there are a lot of conversation partners out there that want to be involved in this discussion. And so, yeah, I think just kind of, you know, looking out, and even if you're not going to have conversations with them, bringing some of this kind of information into Mormon studies circles, I think is really important. And that's what I was trying to do in my previous essay with Dialogue. It was trying to bring Isaiah scholarship to people who study the Book of Mormon as a serious historical document, because a lot has been written on that. But as I tried to make clear in that essay, they don't really engage with Isaiah scholarship. So I guess there's a similar move is what I'm saying, that I'm doing in all of this literature. And I know that some people don't like it a lot, which I get, but you know, if you are trying to be academic and trying to really understand what was going on in the early 19th century and the real life of Joseph Smith and his contemporaries and what was going on, I think it's important to expand that horizon out a bit more and allow him to be real and human. And, you know, as someone who really engaged with the world around him.
I think that's a great note to end on. Colby, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us about this article. I was both like entertained and enlightened by it. So I'm excited that it's going to be appearing in the fall 2025 issue.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, no, I appreciate you coming on. We hope that you, our listeners, have enjoyed this conversation. Please do check out Secret Societies and the Political Context of Joseph Smith's Rewritten Scripture, like I said, in the fall 2025 issue of Dialogue. And to our listeners, thank you very much for joining us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please do share it with friends or colleagues. And don't forget to leave us a review or to get in touch with us with any comments or questions. We hope that you will tune in for future episodes. This is Caroline Klein. Until next time.
Greetings. My name is Rebecca DeSchweinitz, and I'm thrilled to serve as a board member at the Dialogue Foundation and as one of the hosts of Dialogue Gospel Study. In each episode, which we record live the second and fourth Sunday of every month, we welcome esteemed speakers from a variety of backgrounds to share their insights and perspectives on the Come Follow Me lessons. Our aim is to spark meaningful conversations about the scriptures, to connect them to our personal experiences and to our understandings and explorations of the gospel. To stay in the loop with our upcoming lessons and this opportunity to engage with Mormon thought, culture, and belief, be sure to visit dialoguejournal.com and sign up for our newsletter. By doing so, you'll receive updates and timely links to join our live stream lessons. Additionally, you can catch up on our past guests and episodes by subscribing to Dialogue Journal on YouTube, Facebook, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Dialogue Podcast Network.